thousands of years, tribal elders would sit down with their young children and tell them stories. These stories were always the same. There was never a word out of place. Those stories had to be that way. They had to be accurate. Our children needed to hear the stories as their tribal elders had heard the stories. Because in our culture, it's an oral history, an oral storytelling, and nothing was ever written down. I went through this same process with my grandmother. Her name was May Timbibu. She was the most kind and gentle woman that I'd ever known. She had black hair with deep creases that told of a life of a caring, nurturing tribal elder who loved her people. I remember she would sit for hours and tell me stories about how the coyote stole fire or how the sun got its name. And then with reverence in her tone, she would relate the story of the massacre of Bo'okai. There's an old Indian saying that says, when an old Indian dies, a library burns. And that was never as true as it was about my grandmother. Because of her, as I grew older and I attended school, I developed a great love for history. And then one day in class, I suddenly realized something. None of the stories that my grandmother told me are in her history books. But how could that be? I had always believed that historical events weren't absolute. Events that transpired over time had one conclusion. But as I've gotten older, I've come to realize that history is about perspective. Whose perspective? And then one day it became clear to me when I read a quote attributed to the great English leader, Winston Churchill. He said that history is only written by the victors. Well, that makes perfect sense why Native American histories aren't in our history books. Chief Sackwich and his band lived like their forefathers had lived for thousands of years. They were hunters and gatherers, and they traveled with the changing seasons. Sackwich was born in 1822 in northern Utah, near Bear River City. He was born at the beginning of the fur trading era. What that means is he never had a time in his life without the presence of the white men. My Shoshone people refer to themselves as Niwi, which means the people. We looked upon the place, the earth, as not just a place to live, but something so sacred and special that we call her mother. She has always been the provider of our livelihoods. You see, to my native people, the mountains and streams and plains stand forever, and the seasons walk around annually. We traveled to different areas of this country when the game was plentiful and the seeds and berries were abundant. You can imagine it was a hard way of life. We were probably never more than a couple of days away from starvation, but it was a happy life. In the summer of 1847, Sagwich received word that a group of white settlers were making their way through Wyoming and heading towards the Salt Lake Valley. And on July 31st in 1847, Sackwich and 10 of his men had the opportunity to engage that first group of pioneers. Now, they didn't meet with Brigham Young that day because of his illness. They instead met with a man named Heber C. Kimball, who told them that they did not own the land. The land belonged to our Heavenly Father, and they were going to plow and plant it. As you can imagine, with this beginning, things didn't go so well. Sackwich's complicated life was now going to be more complicated. Over the next few years, as more and more pioneer saints came to this wonderful valley, good land was now becoming scarce. In 1856, the church sent a man named Peter Mon north to settle the Cache Valley for good. That one act would have a devastating effect on my people. Not long after, other saints began to arrive to this valley. In those early days, the Mormon pioneers referred to Sackwich and his people as the friendly ones. As more and more saints arrived, and the resources began to become scarce, they started calling us thieves and beggars, which was probably true from their perspective. The irony, though, in that for me, is that the Mormon people themselves had suffered so much hate and injustice on their trek across this country. It's hard for me to believe that they could be found guilty of doing the same to my people. Peter Mon, who is now the area authority in the Cache Valley, said this: "With extraordinarily good luck, the California volunteers will wipe them out. We wish this community rid of all such parties. And if Colonel Connor can be successful in reaching that bastard class of humans who play with the lives of the peaceful and the law-abiding citizens in this way, we shall be pleased to acknowledge our obligations." So, with this development, the use of the California and Oregon trails that brought immigrants from the east, that cut through the heart of Shoshone land, our people had three options: beg for food, starve, or steal. In early January of 1863, the Mormon settlers in Cache Valley and those using the Oregon trails began writing letters and making requests for the government to put an end to the Indian depredations. Arrest warrants were issued for Sagwitch, the chief, Chief Bear Hunter, Chief Sandpitch, Chief Pocatello. Patrick Connor, the colonel at Camp Douglas, now Fort Douglas, was now mustered into service. A Mormon scout named Porter Rockwell served as a guide for $5, and he took Colonel Connor and his men just north of Logan, Utah, near Preston, Idaho, where Beaver Creek meets Bow Ogi, or what you probably know as the Bear River. On the night of January 27th, an old medicine man by the name of Tintup had a dream. In his dream, he saw his people being killed by Pony soldiers. He woke everyone up and told them to move that night. Some of the families believed Tintup and moved, about 50, and their lives were spared. In the meantime, a white friend of the Shoshones, a man named Frank from Franklin, Idaho, had stopped by to say that the saints from Cache Valley were making plans to completely get rid of our people. So the Shoshone knew they were coming. Chief Sagwitch, being an early riser, got up as usual on the morning of the 29th. He stood outside his teepee and surveyed the area around his camp. The hills to the east appeared to be covered in a steaming mist, a cloud, as he called it, and the cloud seemed to lower along the bluff. And then suddenly he realized what was taking place. It was the horse's breath, 250 of them from Camp Douglas. The soldiers had arrived. He wasn't surprised. He started calling to his sleeping village. Some of the women were so excited, they gathered what was ever in sight to use for shields, their woven willow baskets, and winnowing pans. Some of the men ran towards the river and dropped into the plague box holes that had been dug in the summer months by the children. Colonel Connor and his men approached and began to fire upon my people. But what was an arrow compared to the rifles and sidearms of the soldiers? The Indians were now being slaughtered like rabbits. Indian men, women, and children were being butchered left and right. As one local Franklin settler said, the soldiers massacred men, women, and children and held infants by their heels while they beat their brains out on any hard surface they could find. Most all of the action took place among the willows and along the riverbank. The massacre started early in the morning and lasted for about 4 hours. The Bear River, which was slightly frozen earlier, was now starting to flow. The Shoshone people were now jumping into the river to try to escape. The blazing white snow, if you can imagine, was brilliant red with blood. The willow trees that were used as hiding places were bent down as if in defeat. The old dry leaves that had been clinging to the willows were flying through the air like whizzing bullets. Local Mormon resident Alexander Stalker noted that once the Indians had been routed, the soldiers pulled their pistols and shot many of the Indians directly in the face at arm's length. Soldiers then began to burn the lodges and killed those who were still alive. Many of our women were jumping into the river with their young children. Most all of them died. An Indian woman named Angie Chi was being chased by the soldiers. She jumped into the river and went under an overhanging bank. By doing this, she was saved. She watched the massacre from her hiding place after trying to tend the 7 bullet wounds to her torso. Angie Chi carried those scars for the rest of her life. She also told of having to drown her own baby so that as to not give up her location and that of others. The cruelest killing, though, was that of Chief Bear Hunter. Perhaps it was the cruelest death in the white Indian struggle. Knowing that he was one of the leaders, the soldiers shot him, stabbed him, whipped him, kicked him. Through all of this, that old chief wouldn't die or wouldn't even cry out for mercy. Because of that, the soldiers became angry. One of the men stepped to a burning campfire and heated that bayonet on the end of his rifle till it was glowing red. He then ran that hot piece of metal through that chief's head from ear to ear. Chief Bear Hunter went to his grave a man of honor. He also left behind a wife and 8 children. At the end of the massacre, Connor and his men allowed a handful of Mormons to walk the village turned massacre ground. James Martineau, a local pioneer, was sickened by what he saw, including the rape of women. He noted that many of the squaws were killed because they would not lie down and be ravished. Martineau later reported to Peter Mons sickening accounts of inhumane acts by the soldiers as related to him by the squaws. They still remained on the ground. After they had routed the Indians, they killed the wounded by knocking them in the head with an axe and then commenced to ravish the squaws. The Shoshone people who had escaped watched as the wagons left the camp. As they drove off, my grandmother said they made a mournful sound as they squeaked across the snow. By nightfall, the Indians who had escaped were cold and wet and hungry. There was no food to be found. The soldiers had done a good job of scattering the food and setting fire to it. All of the lodges, the teepees, were burned to the ground except one. That lone teepee looked as if it was made out of net, and it was that of Chief Sagwitch. After the soldiers had gone, Sagwitch made his way to his teepee, stepped inside, and found his wife dead. Beside her was an infant daughter who was still alive. Sagwitch ordered some of the men who had come with him to take that little baby from its mother and put her in a cradle board and hang her in a nearby tree. He then knew that without nourishment from its mother, that the baby would die anyway. And that's what happened. The next morning, a Franklin family picked her up and raised that little girl to adulthood. And that little girl ended up dying an old woman at 95, and she's buried in the Hooper City Cemetery in Weber County. And she was known throughout her life as Jane Holm, Sagwitch's daughter. The surviving Indians couldn't believe what had just taken place. They were probably remembering that just days before, the camp had been a happy place. They were remembering the many seasons the Northwesterns spent on the Bear River. The next morning, local Mormons, William Hurd, William Nelson, and William Hull traveled to the massacre site looking for survivors. Hull later wrote in his journal, "We drove our sleigh as far as the river. The first sight to greet us was an old Indian man walking, slowly with arms folded, his head bowed in grief, lamenting the dead. He didn't speak to us, and he soon left, going towards the north. Never will I forget the scene. Dead bodies were everywhere. I counted 8 deep in one place, and in several other places there were 3 to 5 deep. All in all, we counted more than 400, 2/3 of them being women and children. We found 2 Indian women alive whose thighs had been broken by the bullets. 2 little boys and 1 little Indian girl was at the age of 3 were found still alive. The little girl was badly wounded, having 8 bullet wounds to her body. We took them on our horses to the sleigh and made them as comfortable as possible. I can't help but feel the sack, which was now realizing that he lived in 2 different worlds. One group to him must have been greedy and wanted everything. The other group only wanted to live and travel as they'd always lived. One group there made their wishes and dreams come true by making themselves the conqueror at the expense of a defenseless people who only wanted to be left alone. A local Mormon resident, Ralph Smith, summed up the sentiments of the local Mormons when he said this: "The massacre was gruesome, but necessary." And added, "The work of Patrick Connor and the soldiers was nothing less than an intervention from our Heavenly Father." As news of the massacre began reaching those in Logan and Wellsville, some of the local communities, some of the feelings of the local saints began to emerge. Mary Ann Weston Maughan, wife of Peter Maughan, wrote that the residents of Cache Valley looked upon Connor's efforts as an imposition in their behalf and commented that the Indians had caused so much trouble that patience had ceased to be a virtue. Henry Ballard, Bishop of the Logan First Ward, said this: "This put a quietness upon the Indians. The Lord raised up his foe and Colonel Connor to punish them without us having to do it. We have bore a great deal from them, and yet have still been feeding them. And yet some of the wicked spirits among them would stir up trouble against us." George Farrell, Secretary of the Logan Second Ward, recorded in the official minutes: "We, the people of Cache Valley, look upon the movement of Colonel Connor as an intervention from the Almighty, as the Indians have been a great source of annoyance to us for a long time." And finally, Bishop Peter Maughan, in a letter dated to Brigham Young on February 4th, as he tabulated the number of killed, said this: "I feel my skirts rid of their blood. They rejected the way of life and salvation that had been pointed out to them from time to time. And thus they have perished, relying upon their own strengths and wisdom." It may seem impossible to expect the saints in the Cache Valley and other places to adhere to the same policy that Brigham Young had always preached, that it was easier to feed the Indians than to fight them. So over the years, how did the people of Cache Valley come to terms with this event, and how did they want that past to be remembered? Just north of Preston, Idaho today, on Highway 91, there's an old monument erected in 1932 by the good people of Franklin. It was meant to tell the history of the events of that fateful day. In 1932, the first plaque gave a history. Troops engaged 500 Shoshone Indians, including 90 women and children combatants. They killed approximately 250. 18 soldiers died and 4 officers. And 90 suffered frostbite. 20 years later, the Utah Daughters of Pioneers, not to be outdone, put another plaque up on there. The whole community came together for this event to tell their story. I want you to know that humans have great memories for what they want to remember. Mm-hmm. In commemorating the battle, you forget the uglier parts and you focus on the heroism of the soldiers and the saints. That becomes the story of the second plaque that exists there today. But that narrative now becomes the story. It's not a story about my people. It becomes a story about the brave soldiers and the wonderful pioneer woman who took care of them. In constructing a monument like that, you firm up memory and you create history. What the monument really accomplished for me is that it gives people a reason to forget. A monument strips us of our obligation to find out for ourselves what actually took place. And a monument always tells us how it wants the past to be remembered. The second plaque reads this way: attacks by the Indians on the peaceful inhabitants in this vicinity led to the final battle here on January 29th. The conflict occurred in deep snow and bitter cold. Scores of wounded soldiers were taken from the battlefield to the Latter-day Saint community of Franklin. Here, pioneer women, trained through trials and necessities of frontier living, accepted the responsibility of caring for the wounded until they could be removed to Camp Douglas, Utah. Two Indian women and their children found alive after the encounter were given home to Franklin. So here's my question. Is that really what happened? The problem with that narrative for me is it gives us one point of view from one generation's perspective, 69 years after the actual event. It's like a view from a small window that has been carefully placed to exclude a whole quadrant of a beautiful landscape. You only get to see what they want you to see. It also reinforces the view that Indians were savages and went so far as to label our women and children as enemy combatants. It reinforced the view that violence on the frontier was necessary for the survival of Mormon communities and showed what the consequences would be when both groups tried to share the same space. What if the plaque had been written from the Shoshone perspective? Would it have read the same way? Maybe you would have said this: the massacre of the Northwestern Band occurred in this vicinity on January 29th. Colonel Patrick Connors, Command of California Volunteers, attacked a sleeping Indian village in the early morning hours of the day. The soldiers shot, raped, bludgeoned, and bayoneted several hundred men, women, and children to their death. The Indians fought back with the limited weapons that were available to them, but the band was all but annihilated. So which version of the massacre is correct? The answer will lie in your perspective. The events that took place on that cold January morning have long been forgotten by most, and I would dare to say, for you locals that grew up here in Utah, didn't even know. Maybe guilt or remorse has silenced all those who one day may have wanted to know the truth. But I hope a new generation will have a desire to listen and to learn. Not because we're looking to have it made right. We're not. But I believe that those who gave their life at Bear River that day have a God-given right to be heard. Their voices speak to us from the dust. If you're there at just the right time in the evening, you can sit and you can hear the cries of the little ones crying for their mothers. Your senses tell you that you're among the spirits of more than 400 children of the Great Spirit who created us all. You don't have to see things as they were then to know the terrible injustice that had taken place at that site. You can feel it. So, for the next 10 years, Sagwitch and the survivors continued to scratch out a meager existence. Their way of life had been drastically altered by the coming of the Mormon pioneers. But all of that changed in 1873. Native American leaders in Sagamidge began having dreams and other spiritual manifestations. One night, Sagamidge was visited by three men who appeared to him in a dream and told them of the existence of a God among the Mormon people. He was told that he needed to send somebody to Salt Lake in search of this God that would tell them how they must live their life from that point on. The next day, Sagamidge traveled to Ogden to meet a well-known Indian, a white man who had been a missionary to the Indians. His name was George Washington Hill. Hill had served a mission to the Lemhi Shoshones in central Idaho in 1855. And was well versed in the Shoshone language. Hill told Sagamidge that there was order in the Lord's church and he was no longer a missionary, that he needed to go to Salt Lake and make the request. 1 week later, Brigham Young called George Hill to his office and said that there was a heavy burden on his shoulders and it was now going to be his. He then called George to be a missionary to the Shoshone people in the North Country, according to his journal. 1 month later, George Washington Hill baptized Sagamidge and 101 survivors in the Bear River, the same Bear River which 10 years earlier Sagamidge watched the entire destruction of his people. Our conversion, though, into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is in the story here today. But it serves as a backdrop of who my people are and how we are a little different from other Indian tribes. Accepting an organized religion taught us principles of success and hard work. We were taught to farm. We were taught to work hard and pay our taxes and contribute to society. It made us better equipped to handle the changing world. Assimilation kept us off government-sponsored reservations where alcoholism, drug abuse, and unemployment run 5 to 10 times the national average. Our tribal office today is located in Brigham City. We provide our members with housing options for the elderly, health care, and free education for anybody that wants to go to college. We are your neighbors. We live along the Wasatch Front. We're active participants in our communities. We are engaged with you. We as a tribe realize that education is a key to our future. Our younger generations are now coming back to serve our people. Our CFO, for example, got his bachelor's and master's in accounting from the University of Utah, moved to Boston and worked 7 years as an accountant with PricewaterhouseCoopers before returning home to serve as our CFO. We have 3 tribal businesses that help us raise money. Those businesses have allowed us to purchase 700 acres of the Sacred Massacre site. And now I'm in the process of raising an additional $5 million to build a beautiful interpretive center to tell our story. It's important that we protect those who have gone before. You see, being a Native American for my people isn't an entitlement program like it is for most. We have chosen a different path. We have chosen to control our own destiny and create our own history. But we remember the past. And you need to remember the past as well, because it allows you to succeed in the future as you look at mistakes. Someone said, never let your past experiences harm your future. Your past cannot be altered, and your future doesn't deserve the punishment. We are grateful that past negative experiences didn't alter Sagamidge's future, because it would have altered mine. The most successful Native Americans today are those who can best balance culture and change. We honor our culture. We honor those people who have gone before, our ancestors. They are important to us. We honor them and their traditions. But we as leadership realized a long time ago that we live in an ever-changing world. And we are trying to prepare our children to change and succeed with it. The massacre at Bo Ogai has taught me many lessons over the years. It has taught me that bad things happen to people. They happen to you and I. And if they haven't happened to you yet, just wait. How you respond to those events will determine your character and who you become. It has taught me to always offer unconditional forgiveness. But that doesn't mean we need to forget. It has taught me that ordinary people, you and me, can affect real change. My grandmother refused to accept the narrative on the plaque. The National Park Service had a big sign at the site that says, "Here is the site of the Battle of Bear River." Because of one little old grandmother who testified in front of Congress 10 times, she had that sign changed by the National Park Service to call it what it was. It's now called the Bear River Massacre. It's taught me, and why we're here today, that everyone has a story worthy of being told. What is your story? Your story is equally as important as mine. And as you share your story with people you work with, clients, anybody, it's important that they feel they'll forget the facts and figures. Make them feel if you want to accomplish something. And it has taught me that the souls of my ancestors peer out from behind my mask of skin, and that through my memories, they get to live again. I hope we never forget where we come from. Ultimately, though, the story of the Bear River Massacre is our story. And in some ways, I hope you can respect the story that we want to have told, as well as recognize your role in that story. You see, history doesn't always affirm us. Sometimes history challenges us to think about an uglier past that we'd rather not have. But that's really the power and the benefit of history. It connects us to the past. It connects us to our humanity and our inhumanity. And it offers us a way to move forward, especially in a circumstance like this with the Shoshone people. Moving forward in a story that connects us, not in the prettiest of ways, but to move forward to a new relationship that is a 21st century relationship based on respect. Respect for the truth and what happened in that past moment. Then, that is when you get the possibility for reconciliation. The past is a complex story made up of many interwoven lives and experiences that all of us happen to go through. As we move forward to this new relationship, we need to take into account all of our stories. If we are to have a history in a country that includes all people equally, storytelling has allowed me in the last 9 months to raise $2.5 million out of the $5 million needed to build that interpretive center. And it's the only way we've been able to do that. If I were to stand in front of a group and say, well, 400 people were killed, 18 troops died, and give them the facts and not give them what you heard today, I wouldn't have raised any money. But I haven't spoken in front of a group that hasn't been willing or touched or not wanting to help. And I don't care what you do for a living, as you go back to your jobs, think about the humanity. Think about what we're missing in history. Think about the feelings. Think about listening with your heart as you engage those people around you. This has been wonderful. but I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here today. So thank you. Any questions from anybody before we go? Sorry, this wasn't interactive like some of the presentations I've sat through. I'm not an interactive guy. But I am a storyteller. Yeah.
You have a wonderful way of telling stories. If you ask for a question, the question I would ask is, what efforts are being made to release the Shoshone, for example, or any Indian nation, into the community so that they can become part of the world community? You know, we all have this horrible history of one war against another, one country overtaking another. I think if you were to ask anybody here, they would all say, yes, I'm part German, I'm part French, I'm part English, I'm part Irish, because there's been some amalgamation. And I think you know that as you keep a tribe together, you're getting cousins marrying cousins, and then you're perpetuating serious illnesses, which is not good for later generations. You know, as I mentioned to you earlier, I worked with the Chippewa and the Sioux and the Blackfoot and the Cree and the Mi'kmaq. And I think as long as they stay isolated, as long as it's cousins marrying cousins, then you're heading for future generations of problems. So coming back to my original question, you know, what advice or education are you giving to the Shoshone that they should get out and amalgamate with other people for future generations?
My advice, and the only reason we don't navigate those problems is because we didn't grow up on a reservation. We've assimilated into the culture. And if I could just say one thing to my Native American brothers and sisters who aren't here today, get educated and move your butts off the reservation and make a difference somewhere. That would be my hope and goal. The government has no favors when it moved us to a reservation. Think about how we lived 200 years ago. Every member of the tribe got up every day and went and picked seeds and berries for enough food for one day. Everybody worked hard. Today the government has said, move to this land and we'll take care of you. We'll give you money, we'll give you food. And the money that you give, I just talked to a politician yesterday who thought that the natives are ruining in it, that the government gives them money and they just squander it, and that's not true. The tribes get grant money that's earmarked specifically for programs, but it's never enough. It's always under the poverty level. So get an education and move. Make a difference in your communities. That would be my advice to you. Make a difference in your communities. Love more. Extend a hand in friendship. Don't let things and past experiences with things divide us. Just one other thought before I leave. One of my best friends is Sherman Reyes, the Attorney General. I had a meeting with him, and right, I got to the meeting about 30 minutes early, and his chief of staff saw me sitting there in the lobby, and he grabbed me and said, you gotta see this, come with me. He took me into Sean's office, and we sat at the back. Sean was up front by his desk with a group of 8 Afghan governors. They didn't speak English. They looked like Afghan governors to me. And my perception and my biases that I've gotten from the news. And so I watched them interact through an interpreter. And then towards the end, as Sean was getting ready to close it down, they were here on a trade mission. The chief of staff got Sean's attention and pointed to me. And then Sean said, through the interpreter, do you want to meet a real Indian chief? And they all nodded, yes, they did. And probably they were waiting for the Hollywood version of the Indian chief. And there I am in the back. And he called me up. And I got to shake every one of their hands and look at them face to face. And I'll tell you, preconceived notions and biases and scary things that I'd heard about Afghan people dissipated. And all I could see was love. As we get close to people and let people in our space, that's when real things happen. And that would be my call for you. So thank you very much for coming today.